Eternal Father, we thank you for the blessings we've enjoyed in our fellowship over the break. We thank you for the fruits of the earth, very comfortable circumstances to be in. We think about what needs to be said tonight. I pray that you give us perception and understanding. Father, we live in a fallen world, and many times that fallen world is a terrible world. Father, if it's not against your will, we ask that you would spare us the ravages of what I share tonight. Be present here, Father, to impact our hearts with your truth. We commit the evening to you, asking you to accomplish your purposes for your glory and our good. In Jesus' name, amen. This is a remnant from our previous discussion. Anything that I have that you would like copies of, that I share with overheads, you're certainly welcome. And you might be particularly interested in this one. We could turn some lights off up here in the front. You'll notice this is a timeline of the Amish Mennonites. This is not of the regular Mennonites. So this is only, really not my story. It's part of your story. But you notice this timeline begins with 1850. And it ends in 2008. Now, this is made by Corey Anderson. Some of you might know him. Okay, so as relates to your story, Amish Mennonites came over from Europe in the first and second migrations, like I shared with you the first evening. But they had these Dinarver Samlungs in various places in the late 1800s, and the Amish people sorted themselves out. Two-thirds became Amish Mennonites. I'm sorry, they were always Amish Mennonites, but they became known as change-minded Amish. And the other people who were non-change-minded Amish became what we know as Old Order Amish today. There was no such thing as Old Order Amish back in 1800. When they came here, there was no such thing as Old Order Amish. Okay, so once they sorted themselves out, you'll notice that the Old Order Amish continue to this day. Now, these Amish Mennonites, this is what's really interesting. Here is the Egley Amish. We talked about them just in the last session. 1866, they grew out of these change-minded Amish. And as they continued to change, you notice that they did not stop with the Mennonites. This is my branch. They went from there up into Protestantism. And I think you go to the church today, they have a flag standing right inside the front door. And that would be illustrating of that move. As time went on, these people divided themselves up into conferences as well. They patterned themselves after us. But then eventually they joined with us. A, at the Indiana-Michigan Conference, 1916, they joined up with us. The Western District, which was Illinois, in 1920, joined up with us. The Eastern District, I think that's Ohio and Eastern. I think that's what we're referring to, Amish Mennonite. Ohio and Eastern AM, my parents used to say. Okay, in 1927, they joined with us. This is Mennonite Church USA today. And you'll notice the rest just disappeared. There is no such thing as change-minded Amish today. It says many remaining churches gradually lost Amish Mennonite identity, become unaffiliated Mennonite churches. Okay, we can talk about some of those. I don't know if you have any of these in this area or not. Now let's go back here. A group of these people did not want to continue to make these changes. And there was a man in Indiana called John Kaufman, and later on, and I think in Ohio, in Iowa, there was Noah Troyer, who became known as Sleeping Preachers. Sleeping Preachers. Some of you might know that story. Well, they separated out under the Sleeping Preachers' influence and became Amish Mennonites, but they're very different Amish Mennonites. You might know them as Tampico Amish or Buffalo Amish Mennonites. And they're in Missouri, especially in Illinois around Tampico. And they continue to this day. But you'll notice that they became much more conservative. Okay, I'll just stop there. As time went on, there were a group of people who did not like what was happening up here. And there were some older Amish people who wanted to join forces with them. They created what is called Conservative Mennonite Conference. Do you have those down here? CMC churches?
No, we don't.
Where I live in northern Indiana, we have quite a number of those. Conservative Conference. Or sometimes up there, they're just called conservatives. In our area, we know them because they wear black coverings that are about this big. Okay, little doilies. In 1999, this conference had gone so far that the defining issues were becoming head coverings and divorce and remarriage, the same things that our people faced back in the 60s. And so what you call BMA was born. Do you have any BMA churches around here?
No, there's one in Albert.
Okay.
I don't think there's any closer.
Okay, so these people are the new kid on the block. They are just getting started. They have not created a history yet. They're in the process of doing that. Okay? Back here. Out of the Old Order Amish, there was such a thing as Beachy Amish that started in 1927. And you notice that the line here runs parallel with the Conservative Conference. It's just that it's further down. Now, out of those people, there are breakoffs such as the Old Beachy Churches. Basically, they're Amish people who drive cars. You've probably heard of the fellowship movement. I'm not talking about nationwide fellowship now. I'm talking Mennonite Christian fellowship that began in 1978. They continue to this day. As time went on, there were Berea Amish Mennonites. The Maranatha, and Brother Allen tells me about them. They came off in 1999. And then since that time, the Ambassadors. Okay, so this is ongoing history. And you folks, if they make one of these charts several years down the road, you'll probably be included somewhere. Okay? Now, like I say, this is just the Amish diagram. There's a Mennonite diagram, too. So this, to me, really helps put things in perspective. Okay, so that's all I was going to say about that, unless somebody has some particular questions before we leave this. Yes? Roselawn, Riverview, Griner. I think Griner actually withdrew Conservative Council. Have you ever heard of Rosedale, the Rosedale Bible School? That is their official Bible school. But that's in Ohio, over at Plain City. Town Line Mennonite in our area. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Yes. The only thing I can figure out is kind of nebulous. This is a clearly defined fellowship, and this evidently is not so clearly defined. That's the only thing I can figure out. Oh, sure enough. Thank you, Alan. Indicate the nested group within Beachy churches. See, all these people call themselves some kind of Beachy. But these people are the most organized of all that.
But don't they call themselves fellowship?
Yeah, they do. Yeah. Okay, any other questions? Okay, we'll just leave that. Now, what I have to share with you next is just an awful story. This is not very inspirational, so that's why we're not doing it tomorrow morning. One of the reasons that the Bible is a great book is that it doesn't tell just the good stories. It tells the good and the bad stories. The victories and the defeats. If you read pagan history, they only tell you about the battles they won. For example, when Assyria writes its history about the time that they came to besiege Jerusalem, in Hezekiah's day, and you know how the scriptures say that an angel went out and destroyed 185,000 of the soldiers. Okay, that's a huge defeat. It is a miraculous defeat. But the Assyrian story simply says, we encountered strong kings in Judah. That's all they say. Because in paganism, you really don't want to admit defeats. Everything is good. Because if you don't have good things, you don't have a good God. And you have to placate your God to make him happy. And if you didn't get successes, maybe you didn't do well enough. With Christianity and Judaism, is completely different. God has a people. And you don't placate him so that he blesses you. You serve him. And when you serve him, he does bless you. But if you don't serve him, there are consequences. There are always consequences. And the Bible records the consequences of people who didn't do it God's way. That's what makes the Bible great. There's both the negative, terrible stories. You know, one of the worst stories you can read is the story at the end of Judges. That's an awful, awful story. But yet it's in the Scriptures. Okay. What I have to tell you tonight is an awful, awful story. So bad. I didn't even know it existed until a few years ago. I started researching this and then it came out. When I went to the library to research this, the librarian said to me, she said, obviously we don't put this out front. Because it's so embarrassing. How in the world did this story ever happen? But it did happen, and I've got to tell you the story. It's an illustration of, in Scripture it says, what we sow, give time, we reap. Scientifically say, every cause given time has an effect. Ideas have consequences. And so, it's extremely important how we think. Before we get started, here are three terms. American, Mennonite, and Christian. Now, if you take two of those and make them adjectives and one of them is a noun, which is the noun and which two are the adjectives? You have any ideas? What are you here at Fern Christian Fellowship? Are you Mennonite Christian American? Are you Christian American Mennonite? Or are you American Mennonite Christian? Or other combinations? What are you?
I heard you give it before.
You be quiet. What are you? This is not a trick question. Yes. Why did you put Christian last? That's the noun. You're right. The noun is the strongest word. Adjectives are weaker words than noun. So you need to be Christian first. Now, it's also true that you're American, and it's also true you're Mennonite or Amish Mennonite. And so those two have to be the weaker, and I think the very weakest should be up front. And so I think you're probably this one. You consider yourself this one right here. I hope you do. If I'm getting the story right, your neighbors up the road that we were talking about earlier may call themselves this. Is that true? But they even dropped this off. Ideas have consequences. I shared this with you the first session. Anyone who contemplates history cannot help but notice how the gift of blessed forgetfulness is given to virtually every generation in the unrolling years of history. This gift that makes it possible for a given age in the midst of its blithe optimism to repeat the fatal mistakes of a previous generation with hardly a pang of remorse or fear. By the mid-1700s, the Mennonites in Germany were losing their Anabaptist worldview. They spent 100 years losing their non-resistance one step at a time. I did not bring this book with me, but I have a book in my library entitled Mennonite German Soldier. About this thick, that chronicles all the small steps that these people went through in their decline. Non-resistance is such a significant doctrine that you don't drop it overnight. It took 100 years for these people to finally get rid of it. But they did. And so by 1900, they were ready to take up arms. World War I cost them 400 German Mennonite soldier deaths. By World War I, they had already lost it, and so therefore, they participated in the war and lost 400 Mennonite soldiers. But they had come to love the martial spirit of their times. Let me pause here. In Germany, the Mennonites, just as Mennonites are today, and Amish, they're kind of reserved people. They're kind of quiet. They have Gelassenheit. And as their young people looked out, they saw bands playing. They saw people wearing uniforms. There was a martial spirit of the time. We are proud people. We are going to go forth with aggression, and we're going to make things happen. And the Mennonites thought, our own people are kind of slow, crude, and kind of dim-witted. And the people around us know what they're doing. We don't. And so, they bought into the martial spirit of their times. They're going to get with it. They're going to be relevant to Germany. They're going to become thoroughly German. We love Germany. Eventually, they become German instead of Christian. They substitute German for Christian. Serious thing. Ideas have consequences. The Prussian German Mennonites were mostly assimilated in Prussia by the late 1800s and desired to partake of all the positive elements of being German and wanted to participate fully in German society. You'll notice that a number of these overheads, I have a source. If you would like to search this out yourself, I mean, these are not my ideas. I'm not even condensing things from books. I mean, I got this stuff right from these sources. So you can check it out for yourself. On the other hand, the Mennonites wanted to maintain the cultural and religious traditions that gave them a strong sense of group identity and a strong sense of connection with their cherished history. So how do you do both of those? How do you buy into the German zeitgeist and at the same time maintain your cultural and religious traditions? You can't. So these people were faced with a choice. The Prussian Mennonites were familiar with the martyr's mirror, but they chose to believe that the past did not apply to the present. The martyr stories were good for that day, but not applicable for the present day. Does that sound any way familiar? The German Mennonites outgrew their Anabaptist forefathers, such as Menno Simons. Instead, they adopted the ideas of Julius Wellhausen, a German rationalist scholar. His higher criticism claimed that the Bible was a sublime collection of human documents. Human reason was to be trusted, not the supernatural claims of the Bible. A culture cannot lose its philosophic center without the most serious of consequences, not just to the philosophy on which it was based, but to the whole superstructure of culture and even each person's notion of who he or she is. Everything changes. With leadership from Lutheran and Baptist-trained pastors who encouraged church-state cooperation. Pause. Do you remember in the last session I said that Anabaptists pioneered the separation of church and state at the price of their blood? That is the biggest contribution that Anabaptism has made to Western history. These people are saying we got to go back to the state church concept. The seminaries that they were sending their young men to were saying we got to put church and state back together. The Mennonites were one of the few Christian denominations founded on the theology of radical nonconformity and non-resistance. When they lost this concept, they were left without a substantial theological foundation for resisting Nazism. I've already talked about some of this in a previous session. I think it was the first session. When it comes to conscience, Anabaptists have always understood there is such a thing as an individual conscience, me and God and I, and there's a collective conscience, we, God and us. Whereas the Protestant theology is basically just God and I. So, if you take liberal, individualized theology, and you put with it conservative political views, you get Mennonite German Nazis without a two-kingdom concept. And that equals impotence against Satan and recognized by the Nazis. In 1924, Adolf Hitler wrote, "By their fruits ye shall know them. Puritans, Anabaptists, Jehovah's Witnesses, those are the juiciest ones. In each one of them sits the Jewish maggot." In 1928, Adolf Hitler said this, "We tolerate no one in our ranks who attacks the ideas of Christianity. Our movement is Christian." Did you hear that? "We tolerate no one in our ranks who attacks the ideas of Christianity. Our movement is Christian." There he is. Now, I want somebody who is age 17 through 12 in this audience right now to tell me what this is right here. Raise your hand if you know. Got one hand. Is that all? Okay, hold on. If you know, if you're age 12 to 17, put your hand up if you know what this thing is. I'm not talking about the man now. I'm talking about this symbol on his arm right here. See that? Okay, I have one hand, two hands, three hands. Okay, young man, what is it? Yeah, but what do we call this Nazi symbol? Yes, it's a swastika. What does the swastika look like? What's it patterned from? Yes? A broken cross. This symbol has become known as the very symbol of evil because it grows out of what happened during this man's regime. In 1924, a Mennonite West Prussian congregation wrote about the rise of Adolf Hitler. "God gave our German people a Führer who knows how to unite our nation with God's strength. Our prayers go out to him. May God bless him and arm him with his strength, not only become a leader toward unity, but also a leader for us and for our German people toward God and our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ." In 1933, the German Mennonites wrote to Adolf Hitler, quote, The Conference of the East and West Prussian Mennonite meeting today in Tegenhagen in the Free State of Danzig is grateful for the great uplift which God has given our people through your strength of will, and also pledges its enthusiastic willingness to cooperate with the building of our fatherland with the strength of the gospel, true to the motto of our fathers, on other ground can no man lay a foundation than Jesus Christ. Pardon? No, this is Menno Simons' quote down here, for other foundation. So that, they're alluding to that. And they're applying that now to Adolf Hitler. We appreciate, Adolf Hitler, that you're helping build on the foundation of Jesus Christ. Hitler wrote back to the Mennonites, "The content of your letter reveals true loyalty to me and your readiness for the cooperation with the construction of the German Reich, and I extend my sincere thanks." But Adolf Hitler promoted the idea of social Darwinism, the idea that the strong survive and the weak die off because they lose in the competition. Christianity and its notion of charity should be replaced by the ethic of strength over weakness. Peace, humility, and meekness were weakness. Something is changing here. Adolf Hitler says, "I want to raise a generation of young people devoid of conscience, imperious, relentless, and cruel." And this man, Adolf Hitler, was one person who led millions into untold evil, including obliterating his victims at the rate of 12,000 persons every single day at the Auschwitz death camp. Now, let me pause right here. How many of you have been to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C.? Raise your hands. Only one of you. I don't consider anybody's education complete without having visited a place like that. The rest of you have an assignment from me, okay, to go visit that place. It's the only place like it that I know, other than what's in Chicago. So many people line up. I guess they still do it to this day, at least it used to be, before they open up. There's a long line of people waiting to get into this place. But once the people get in, it's quiet, just like this. Now, what in the world makes a whole group of people, maybe hundreds of people, deathly quiet? It's what they see there. It's awful. You cannot believe what you see. The Jews knew human nature well enough. If they didn't document what actually happened in World War II to their people, that eventually the world would say, no, it didn't happen. And in spite of their documentation with the Holocaust Museum, the president of Iran has denied that the Holocaust has happened. Anyway. In Chicago in 1978, anti-Semitism was rising in West Chicago, North Chicago, at Skokie. And the Jews decided they've got to build a Holocaust Museum in Skokie, in North Chicago. And they did. I was just up there the other day with some of my students. Once again, it's an effort to document with artifacts and irrefutable evidence that the Holocaust did happen. And once again, I wouldn't recommend you take your children, at least to some parts of that, because of how awful it is. Holocaust Museum in Skokie, Chicago. It's a suburb of Chicago. If you want to go, I guess that's closer than Washington, D.C.
Same thing.
The one in Washington, D.C. is actually a little better than the ones up here. But you come away from this one up here, you're very much impressed. In fact, if you want to take your school or high school, oh, you don't have a school. Sometimes your young people want to do something that is very valuable. Get your parents together, some of you, and just take yourselves as a group up there. I think students, it cost $8 to get in, and I think adults are $12. But it's worth every penny you pay. Give yourself at least several hours to go through it. It opens, I think, at 10 o'clock in the morning and ends at 5 o'clock at night, except on Thursday, I think it runs till 8. I just better stop talking about what's there. You go experience it for yourself. He who knows evil is being done and does nothing to stop it is guilty with the evildoer. Now, I know that can be taken too far, because in the two kingdom concept, there are some things we let God do, but there are some things He expects us to do. And that's what that's referring to. In 1933, Adolf Hitler said, "One is either a German or a Christian. You can't be both." So, the Mennonite principles had always been separation from the world, conformity only to the will of God. They were not going to swear an oath to any earthly ruler. They're going to maintain their non-resistance, all right? But the Nazi principles were to demand conformity to Nazism. This is not a voluntary deal. Demand loyalty to the Nazism through an oath of loyalty. And they were going to subdue the world forcibly in Hitler's name. And so, the desire to remain in Prussia, or we could say the desire to remain German, led the Mennonites into a pattern of compromise. One honest German Mennonite, Joseph Gingrich, noted in 1934, quote, "The danger is great because we have become faint-hearted and unaccustomed to struggle after a long period of religious peace and freedom. And because we quite naturally bristle at recognizing a danger that will shoo us out of our compliant contentedness, since it may well shatter our religious as well as our economic well-being." This man had his head screwed on straight. I don't know what he did about it, but at least he made that comment. In 1934, the German Mennonite Conference eliminated a non-resistant position from its written confession of faith. German Mennonites repeatedly hailed Adolf Hitler as the liberating savior from communism. Now let me pause to stop here. Hitler was very anti-communist. That became very significant to the German Mennonites because the Bolshevik Revolution happened in Russia in 1917. And Lenin was in power for a while, but in the 20s, a man by the name of Joseph Stalin came to power. Joseph Stalin was a man of steel. And he was willing to kill 20 million of his own people to institute communism and its ideas. Okay, their brethren were in communist Russia suffering under Joseph Stalin's leadership. And in a way to relieve their suffering, they would send humanitarian aid over to them to help them to deal with the losses that they're experiencing. But beginning in 1935, the Nazis blocked all the German Mennonite financial assistance to their persecuted brothers and sisters in the Soviet Union. And so when the Nazis said, "Stop it," the German Mennonites meekly submitted to their Lord. Said, "Yes, sir." Does that mean that their brothers over there didn't need any more help? No. Stop because Nazism said stop. At one time, both Jews and Mennonites were welcomed by the German princes who needed their tax money. Both groups aroused popular resentment and persecution because of their economic prosperity. Eventually, German political correctness showcased the prosperous Mennonites for their honesty and industry while declaring that Jewish prosperity undermined German values. Let me pause here a little bit to say that Germany lost World War I. And the peace treaty that came as a result of World War I, called the Versailles Treaty, was very unfair to Germany. Germany was made to bear the cost and to pay reparations for that war. And it very much humiliated the German people. And the German people, it just made them lose their morale. It just wasn't fair economically, politically. And then the Great Depression came and their money was not worth much anything. It was just a terrible time. Okay. The communist and other people blamed the Jews for profiting during World War I. They were willing to invest their money in bonds to supply armaments for World War I. So many people, including the Nazis, blamed the Jews for their losses in World War I. That's just the beginning. There was an old saying that declared, you have to get up pretty early to hoodwink a Jew. But if you want to bamboozle a Mennonite, you can't even go to bed the night before. Okay, that represents or illustrates the resentment that German people had for both Jews and Mennonites. But eventually, one went up and the other one went down in the public idea, public image. German people commonly believed that the Jews were responsible for the German loss of World War I. The Treaty of Versailles unfairly held the Germany responsible for large war reparations, angering the Germans, as well as Adolf Hitler, who was actually wounded in World War I. Thus, Hitler could easily portray the Germans as the victims and the Jews as the victimizers. The Jews would need to be dealt with. Adolf Hitler saying this, "By fighting off the Jews, I am doing the Lord's work." And in his book, Mein Kampf, he writes, "Today I believe that I am acting in accordance with the will of the Almighty Creator." And the German Mennonites engaged in anti-Semitic communication, both verbally and in print. They noted that Jews were part of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. Trotsky himself was a Jew. And profited financially from World War I. They agreed that violence should not be used against the Jews, but the legal restrictions were proper. This attitude was all the Nazis really needed to implement their final solution. The German Mennonites would be passive and silent as the Holocaust happened in their midst. In contrast, the Quakers, corporately and individually, refused to be passive and silent, actively aiding the Jews where and when they could. Adolf Hitler spoke of Germany as a body, with himself as the doctor. Germany was in desperate situation, demoralized, economic problems, political problems. He wanted to make Germany healthy by eliminating diseased, unhealthy parts of the body. Early on, this meant killing the disabled. But because the Nazis also believed that Jews possessed bad genes, they too came to be portrayed by public health experts and scientists as a threat to racial purity and a healthy nation. Adolf Hitler knew he'd have to give some kind of rationale for getting rid of Jews. This is part of it. Said of German Mennonites in the 1930s, this German ethnic mania transformed the public profile of Mennonites. The one-time pesky sect now epitomized Germanness with its steadfast adherence to thrift, sobriety, piety, honesty, and industry. perhaps most significant, was the Mennonite preservation of racial purity. No other German Free Church was lauded with such praise. And the German Mennonites bask in this praise. Now let me pause here and explain what's going on. Do you remember I said that whenever the Mennonites came from Holland to Prussia, that they were not allowed to marry outside their people? They were not allowed to proselytize? Because they intermarried only with their own people, they were able to maintain their racial purity. They were forced to do that by government law around them. What turns out now, that whenever the Nazis needed to give an illustration of the perfect Aryan race and how to do it, they said, look at the Mennonites, they've been doing this for a long time already. They will show us how to do this. And the Mennonites just stood there and just grinned and grinned and grinned. Because they were being blessed and honored before the nation. But the Nazis used the cross and the Bible as they did their work. The Jews ended up crushed and dehumanized, and all the more alienated from the gospel because the symbols of redemption were used by their abusers. Until this was all said and done, many Jews who didn't die ended up as atheists. I'm getting ahead of myself. Drowning people abused by the life preserver tend to turn to the safer worlds of agnosticism, atheism, or the vague, pluralistic, feel-good spiritualism, which is the position of most Jews today. They said, if there is a God in heaven, He would never have left the Holocaust to happen. It is so awful. Where was God when this was happening? The Christians, quote, used Christian doctrine to get rid of them and to justify. Did you know that Martin Luther himself thought it was okay to get rid of Jews? The Jews have been traditionally been portrayed by Christians as Christ killers. Well, get rid of the Christ killers. Aren't you doing God's service if you kill Christ killers? And so, German Mennonites would only help Jews if it did not put their own lives in jeopardy. Did the German Mennonites portray themselves as Christians? Yes. Aren't Christians supposed to be merciful and kind? Yes. But politically, it was not proper or politically correct to be kind and helpful to Jews. And so, once again, they said, yes, sir. They became German instead of Christian. Uh-oh. From 1920 to 1940, one-third of all Russian Mennonites, their fellow brothers further east in Russia, were arrested and disappeared during Stalin's purges. The watching German Mennonites said in 1936, "The recently resurrected German Reich has become a protective bulwark against the Bolshevik assault. We have remained spared from the horrors suffered by comrades that share our faith and our racial stock in the Soviet Union." Joseph Stalin said, "Death is the solution to all problems. No man, no problems." And that just wasn't an idle idea. He ended up killing 20 million of his own people through purges, abuse, and starvation. In 1937, Hitler ordered all German school children into government schools. He said, quote, "The youth of today is ever the people of tomorrow. For this reason, we have set before ourselves the task of inoculating our youth with the spirit of this community at a very early age, at an age when human beings are still unperverted and therefore unspoiled. This Reich stands and is building itself up for the future upon its youth. And this Reich will give its youth to no one, but will itself take youth and give to youth its own education and its own upbringing." Now here's some more quotes from Adolf Hitler. "He alone who owns the youth gains the future." How fortunate for leaders that men do not think. It's always more difficult to fight against faith than against knowledge. Make the lie big, make it simple, keep saying it, and eventually they will believe it. In 1937, Eberhard Arnold's German Hutterite community was forcibly dissolved and its members deported from Germany. To distance themselves from the Hutterites, the German Mennonites wrote, "The Hutterites belong neither to the German Mennonite churches nor to any other organization within our Free German Mennonite Church." In other words, we are with you, German Reich. We are with you more than we are to our own faith kin. We are willing to forsake our faith kin because we're adopted to you, Nazi. In 1938, official church president Friedrich Werner gave orders that on Adolf Hitler's 49th birthday in April, all Protestant pastors must swear an oath of allegiance to the Führer and the German Chancellor, which were Hitler's two titles. Werner's decree included the words, quote, "Anyone who refuses to take the oath is to be dismissed." German Christians took the oath immediately with joyful hearts and in obedience to inner command. The German Mennonite Church joined the Protestant flow and complied. Once the war started, official German Mennonite publications supported the Third Reich, praised the Nazi armies, rejoiced in their victories, and called for Mennonites to, quote, "lay down their lives for their friends." With the reunion of Danzig with Germany, the Prussian Mennonites praised the act as nothing short of the merciful will of God. In a few short years, the victories crumbled into ashes and bitter tears. This is what Danzig looked like in a few years. They were rejoicing that their reunion with Germany was nothing short of the merciful will of God. 6 years later, that's what it looked like. Ideas have consequences. Until it ceased publication in 1941, the German Mennonite periodical, however you pronounce that, Mennonische Blätter, continued to laud Hitler and his policies, as well as to provide theological and biblical reasons for supporting them. Adolf Hitler said in 1941, quote, "I can't break the church over my knee. It has to be left to rot like a gangrenous limb. But the healthy youth belong to us." When the Nazis permitted the German Mennonites' freedom to exist as a church only if they abandoned all critical public commentary, they had no anchor. So once again, they said, "Yes, sir." Now it has come to the point where you dare not say anything against Adolf Hitler. You may not say anything against the Nazis. So we can ask the question, why did the German Mennonites enthusiastically support Adolf Hitler? Here are some answers. Number one, he provided religious direction early on. Number two, he improved the farming economy, and many Mennonites were farmers. And number three, he created a stronger central government. In other words, he gave hope to a political future. Number four, he worked to destroy communism. Number five, he offered hope to a discouraged Germany. And number six, he offered a comprehensive solution to German problems. Just trust me, believe me, I'll make Germany great again. Does that sound familiar? While the public faces of German Mennonites consistently supported the Nazi regime, this was not a result of cold calculation. Neither did it take place in the absence of soul searching. Nonetheless, their faith failed to provide a perspective that transcended the trappings of their culture and their era. In other words, this happened a little bit at a time. They were kind of concerned when it was happening. They didn't feel the best about it, but what can they do? They thought. The biggest flaw of the Mennonites was not any immediate error. Instead, it was the natural consequence of years of gradual theological adaptations and compromises to better fit within the German community. A little bit at a time. Thus, not one able-bodied Mennonite man of draft age in all of Germany refused conscription in World War II. Some even joined the notorious SS, which are charged with mass extermination. I'll pause right here to tell you a story. The man that I'm going to talk about, I think his name was Schroeder, if I'm not mistaken. Now, to his credit, he did resign his Mennonite membership before he started this. But he decided he's going to join the SS. And so he got one of these new formed gas trucks. And his job was to go out to a Jewish village and get all the Jews to sign their names, sign up, register. They had a certain amount of time to do that. And then a week later, they're supposed to be at a certain place with all their belongings. They're going to be moved. So he would show up with his truck, take them out into a field, and then he'd tell them, all right, take all your clothes off and get in this truck. And so there were so many people, they couldn't do it all at once, so they filled the truck up with people that they could. He started driving, turned the gas on, went around the field, not long enough till they're all dead in the truck, came back to a grave, and they got some of the living Jews there to pull all the dead people off, throw them into this hole. Next group, take your clothes off, get in the truck. So they did it once again until all the Jews in that village were killed. Then he would go on to the next village and repeat the process over and over again. How in the world could a Mennonite participate in that? The consequences for the German Mennonites of abandoning their New Testament principles was complicity with the Nazi regime and being collaborators in the Jewish Holocaust. The most harshly persecuted Christian group in Nazi Germany was the Jehovah's Witnesses. Of a population of 20,000, about half spent some time in concentration camps. At least 1,400 died in the camps, and about 250 were executed for refusing to bear arms. But no Mennonite. Back to the story at Danzig. The consequences for these Prussian Mennonites. When the war turned and the Russians started coming from the east, moving west, they came to Danzig. And when the Danzig inhabitants knew that the Russians were coming, they hastily tried to run and go. Many of them didn't make it. They were caught by the Russians and just killed and slaughtered. A few of them made it. And the ones that made it actually escaped to South America. Some to Uruguay, some to Paraguay, and some to Argentina. My daughter and her husband had moved to Uruguay here some time ago, and we went down to visit. And I knew that there were some of these Nazis in Uruguay. And so I said to the people who lived there, I said, could we visit some of these Nazis, former Nazis? And they said, yeah. And so we got in a car, in a vehicle one day, and drove out to one of these German colonies. And we went into a place, the man's name was Clausen, which is perfect German, Russian Mennonite, or Dutch Mennonite. And they spoke Spanish, and then my guide or my host knew Spanish, and so they interpreted for me. And so we wanted to know about these people and how they were feeling. Are they still Nazi in their attitude or what? Well, I couldn't understand Spanish, but it didn't take me too long to figure out that these are really kind and sweet people. They invited us for a meal and everything. And it turns out that his grandmother was 15 when this happened right here. Just fled for her life. And she said, yeah, we were told that to believe in all this Nazism, but we didn't really participate in that. So, while I'm giving broad brushstrokes here, I'm not saying that everybody fit this bill. But listen, look at this. In spite of the fact that not everybody participated, rather than having their insecure fears of being expelled from Germany by the Nazis realized, the Prussian Mennonites found a much worse fate at the hands of the advancing Soviet army. By the summer of 1945, the Prussian Mennonites lost their 400-year home in the region, and it's been gone ever since. There are still Mennonite graves there. There are probably still houses and buildings that were built by Mennonites there, but there are no Prussian Mennonites there anymore. It's gone. In the early 1945, the Mennonites of the former West Prussia were the hapless victims of the advancing Russian army. A general fear of being caught by the invaders led many to flee to the West. Those who remained or waited too long to escape, usually the sick, the young, and the elderly, suffered mightily at the hands of the Russian army by starvation, rape, bodily injury, torture, deportation to Russia, the loss of life among the horrific events of those days. Congregations and families were torn apart. Most would never see their homeland again. The vibrant communities of Mennonites in the West Prussia were utterly destroyed. So, the war is over, and the Nazis lost. And the Mennonites lost too. How do you come to terms with what you just did? How does a church come to terms with this? Notice, it says it took 30 years before writings addressing the Nazi past came to be written by German Mennonites. Tell me, what's 30 years from 1945? 1975. For many, this was a very painful process. This is actually referring to something earlier. One of the Nazi concentration camps, Stutthof, was located east of Danzig in the midst of Mennonite farmhouses. A large number of smaller camps belonged to this KZ also, and the inhabitants of the area often saw starving prisoners in their striped dress on their way to their places of their forced labor. Some of these concentration camps' victims worked for Mennonites on their farms. That's how much these Mennonites cooperated with the Nazis against the Jews. After the Nazi atrocities became fully known to the public in 1945, the Mennonites found themselves battling the demon of their own creation in the stark realization of having compromised their fundamental tenets of faith by their alliance with one of the most evil regimes in human history. When the Allies liberated those concentration camps and those death camps, they were pretty smart. They said, we've got to open the doors to these camps and we've got to bring the local people and make them, force them to walk through these camps so they see with their own eyes what happened here. And the neighboring Germans did not know what was going on in those concentration camps. They could hardly believe it themselves. The Nazis were at the forefront of science, technology, order, discipline. They were the elite, the cream of the world. What had happened under Nazism made the Nazis and the German people feel like they were on top of the world. Only to have the gates of these concentration camps opened up that they could see what was in their world. Now, how do you come to terms with that? How can you live with yourself? In 1995, now how many years after 1945 is that? 50 years. 50 years, the AMG, a National Coalition of German Mennonites, published the following statement, quote, "Most Mennonites in Germany gave in to the temptations of Nazism and sacrificed the peace witness. Very often they valued their commitment to the state higher than their duties to Mennonite brothers and sisters in the Netherlands and France. Nearly all Mennonites remained silent in the face of Nazi crimes against Jews and others. We can only plead for forgiveness with the words of the Lord's Prayer." I'm saying, at least they said it. After 50 years, at least they got the courage to say this. But that doesn't erase what happened. I'm a friend to Sumner Loomis, who worked with Wernher von Braun in World War II. And Wernher von Braun was in Germany, and he got out before Hitler got him. He came over to this country, and the U.S. government used him to lead out in the space program here in this country. And he said, Sumner Loomis says, "I could never understand why Wernher von Braun did not respect or appreciate Mennonites until Sumner learned this story." Today, even with this statement, many Mennonites are kind of looked down on. You guys, you stand for nothing. They ruined their testimony. Said of a former Mennonite Nazi in 2001, "The majority have not recognized the need for repentance of any kind." While there are an official German Mennonite statement, the majority have never come to terms with it yet. One time I was flying, sitting beside a young German on an airplane, and I said, "What do you have to say about the Holocaust?" And he said, "No, it was a mistake." Is that it? Is it just a mistake? We have friends in Germany by the name of Heiko and Sabine Klein. And when Sabine can just hardly deal with this story. She can't wrap her mind around the fact that her people did this. She understands the significance of this. For others, it's like, "Oh, okay, yeah, we made a mistake." The Mennonite open-mindedness toward the Third Reich was possible when Mennonites left the early separation and integrated into a Protestant society. This pattern has not changed since 1945. And so, I guess we can say, as a result of this, this is a quote. This is not somebody's opinion. I guess it is somebody's opinion, but it's not my quote. Basically saying that the Mennonites are still buying into the German mentality, even though it's not Nazi right now. They have still not gone back to their Anabaptist beginnings and their original values. That has not changed. So you might say there's a certain sense in which they still have not learned their lesson. And so, why did the German Mennonites become Nazis? quote, they were the heirs of groups who, after long centuries of being disadvantaged, had now made tremendous gains and had flourished quickly after adapting to German society. They had long since lost any connection to the critical stance of the first Anabaptists, and their understanding of their own history was revisionist. They adopted the predominant Protestant theology of Lutheranism, according to which the head of state is acting as God's instrument, although there was also some dissent. In general, however, German Mennonites of this time separated their personal religious beliefs from their political opinions. This is written by Simon Wiesenthal, who is, after World War II, became a Nazi hunter. Went over the world trying to find former Nazis and bring them to justice. This is a quote from him. There is no denying that Hitler and Stalin are alive today. They are waiting for us to forget, because that is what makes possible the resurrection of these monsters. That's one of the reasons I'm telling you this story. It's one of the reasons I'm giving you homework to go visit a Holocaust museum. Non-cooperation with evil is every bit a moral obligation as cooperation with good. Evil prospers when good men do nothing about it. Okay, that concludes my presentation. I'll be open it for questions. Anybody have anything you want to talk about? I realize the enormity of this thing is so enormous that we just sit dumbfounded. How in the world could something like this happen?
I was wondering if you had any clarification. You gave us some quotes from Hitler in which he embraced Christianity, and some in which he denounced it, and some in which he used it. So were people aware of these things? Was he saying this to different audiences, or how did that...
Okay, good question. Hitler was a master at managing people. He knew what it would take to get them with him. So he starts out with religion. But he changes slowly enough that he keeps the people with him while he changes. And so once he's saying these drastic things, they're saying, probably in their minds, well, that's pretty strong, but you know, I'm not going to really push it in response. They just kind of adapted to it. And I think that was the way it was the whole way through. Do you have anything more you want to say about that? Okay, I have to be very careful what I say publicly. And I really, you may talk to me privately afterwards, but I'm hoping, if you're sitting here, if your head is screwed on straight, you should be thinking some things. And this brother is. Okay, is there another hand? Yes.
I was just wondering, the ones that the Russian Mennonites that migrated to Canada, to the United States, how do they go back and forth with the so-called Mennonites in Germany today yet, or are they still brothers, or how does that work?
I probably am not the person to answer that question, but they came out of Russia about 1874, and in 1990, we'll say, Germany began to pay to get German Mennonites out of Russia. So from 1990 to 1874, it's over 100 years. How much connection are you maintaining with your cousins, your grandpa's or great-grandpa's brother's children? How much connection are you maintaining? Well, I think for most of us, it's very little. And so my thought is, it's probably very little for those people as well. If so much time had elapsed. Part of what I'm going to share tomorrow is that the ones who stayed in Russia pitied the people who left, because they left right before great and wonderful economic opportunities opened up. The golden era of Russia opened up after they left. They said, you stupid guys, you left when you could have stayed here and benefited. But a few years later, when Stalin was in power and all that trouble came, then the Russians were saying, you guys were smart to leave when you did. Look, folks, I don't know if this, what this says to you sitting here. What it says to me is that we need to have people, like it says in the scriptures about who are the men of Issachar were wise about the times that they were living in. And we may not keep our heads in the sand and just hope and pray that everything keeps working the way it is. We need to be thinking about what's going on around us and what God would have us to do. Should we leave? The question is, if we would leave, where would we go? There is no America around anymore. Now, the old colony Mennonites are finding an answer in Bolivia. A lot of these are open questions, but I just beg of us not to put our heads in the sand and to be thinking about what's going on, asking God to provide ways for us to move forward. Some people would say that we may be just beginning to come into a great opportunity. Do you folks know that the Anabaptist people are the only group of people who have refused to accept divorce and remarriage in their church membership? And a few other things like that were the only ones. You folks live in Indiana. Where I come from in Texas, it's not like this at all. Everybody around here is used to seeing people with head coverings. When you go to Texas, you see anybody with a head covering, you're like, ooh, who's that? We've got to go find out who that is. All you need to do to preach a sermon in Texas is take your family, your Christian family, and go to Walmart. And you preach a sermon. It's like, wow, where did that come from? I'd never seen anything like that. Well, our society is becoming increasingly devoid of God. And the opportunities to show and demonstrate truth and godliness and values are become ever more available to us. In fact, I was over supper time. I was just telling a brother, Reinhardt, about the book is entitled The Thrill of the Chaste. Our society is so pornographic now that one of the reasons why the phenomenal success of the Amish romance books is that usually when you think of romance, it's impure. But here in Amish romance novels, you got pure courtship coupled with the national fascination with Amish. And on top of that, there's an evangelical theology. It has become a selling mix. If you want to make money fast, write an Amish romance novel. The thrill of the chaste. Purity is being valued. Who is pure anymore? And you go, you walk in public, they see purity written all over us. It's like, where did that come from? We are coming into a time, possibly, when we have incredible opportunities. And just maybe God will not allow us to run off someplace this time. Maybe He'll ask us to stay right where we are and bear witness to His truth with a happy, radiant face to the bitter end. I don't know. Yes?
Just to help with what year did they leave for Russia from Danzig, approximately, those Mennonites?
Okay, you mean to go to Russia?
Yeah.
1789, I think it was.
1789.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. It was that early.
Yeah.
Did with the things happening in Germany earlier on, did they continue to some of them kind of dribble over there to Russia?
Okay, the first ones left because they were up against it. They just needed to, and that's part of our story for tomorrow.
Right.
But there were people who kept dribbling along later. In fact, one of the men I would like to talk about tomorrow, if I have a chance, is Cornelius Jansen. he actually came from Prussia. He never even lived over in those colonies. He went straight from Prussia to Berdyansk. Over here.
Yeah, I guess I just have a comment to make. When you said that the Anabaptists are the only ones that don't have divorce, remarriage, and a few other things like that, the head covering, I was just reading in Gary Miller's book the other day, and it said of all the religions in the world, there's 32% that are professing Christians, and of those 32%, there's only 0.1% that are Anabaptists or Anabaptist heritage. Is that?
Do you know how many people we ought to be by now? You do your math. You go home and check with me and see if I'm right. If you take one couple, husband and wife, and they have four children, and each of those four children have four children, and you go 10 generations, do you know how many people that is? That's over 1 million. And you go two more generations, I think it turns into 16 million. So where are Mennonite millions today? Do we only have four children in our families? What has happened? Okay, I don't have this overhead with me. I don't know. I might have it with me. But if you take that same four and one is lost, and you take that same ratio for every generation, do you know that in three generations there are more who are lost than there are more unfaithful than there are faithful? And just talking about numbers, the way numbers multiply, we have had tremendous losses through the years. And I just wonder what God thinks. I mean, I trusted the gospel with you. I favored you. I allowed you to be delivered from persecution. And yet, you turned to the gift and not to me. And we can't lift up our faces to our Heavenly Father and feel good about our stewardship. That's as a people as a whole. The challenge for every one of us as families is we've got to do our homework with our families. And we've got to do, by the grace of God, do all we can and then let the rest with God. But we better do all we can. That's where our problem has been. Many times through our history, we have put economics before faith and has become a stumbling block for us.
You showed a picture and you said to one there was a Mennonite. And the rest look quite a bit like him, but they weren't Mennonite, I'm gathering.
Okay. I think I have it in here. I'd like to read something more since you brought that up. This is in relation to those paintings. These portrait folks were not old Flemish. Without exception, they were rich merchants, printers or artisans from the Waterlander or United groupings. They were pious, certainly, but by this time also well acquainted with the exceedingly attractive aspects of economic prosperity, clothing of fine fabrics, literature, music, art. Paintings from the middle 17th century display Waterlander families in their richly decorated houses, a still life or a landscape with a mill or a seascape on the wall, a child playing the viola di gamba. These are all quotes from a book on the fairs. Another quote, that Mennonites often became rich was a well-known fact. It was precisely their resolute ethical attitude that they were able to acquire enormous capital in a short time. The fact that wealth grew more rapidly with them than in non-Anabaptist circles was because of their frugal consumption patterns and lifestyle. Page 39, a document prepared by the Groningen Old Flemish in 1659 for defining what was and was not allowed in the congregation. This is a statement of faith and practice. Listen to this. Quote, wearing clothing of colored smooth cloth, we call it satin today, was forbidden, as were shoes with high heels, sewed or decorated with white thread, or fastened with straps or pins. Men's trousers were not allowed to have buttonholes, flaps or buttons, a worldly invention. Collars and shirts were not to be ironed. Men were not allowed to wear their hair long or shave in worldly ways. Women were forbidden from using clasp or other metal pins to fasten their hair and or caps. No ribbons or braids in their hair. No gaudy pillows on beds or decorated bedspreads or coverlets. No paintings or decorated plates on the wall. No silver cutlery and cups or any other costly tableware. No mirrors, no colorful floors, and on. That's Old Flemish compared to Waterlanders in 1659. In the 1640s, there were 75 permanent Dutch residents in Danzig, with families and temporary residents adding to the number. There were 55,000 inhabitants of the city. Quote, notwithstanding their influence on the city was considerable. 75 out of 55,000 now. Get that. They controlled Danzig's shipping industry. Between 60 and 90% of the ships entering Danzig Harbor were Dutch owned. They built such efficient ships that freight costs were 1.5 to 3 times lower than non-Mennonite boats. The Dutch not only shined in shipbuilding, but also in their knowledge of trade and administration. They introduced new forms of loans and bills of exchange. They were strong in money trade and credit supply. Danzig and other harbor towns in the Baltic Sea exuded an atmosphere of the Netherlands. Dutch architects, engineers, builders, and artisans settled there. Some were Anabaptists, like the well-known Adam Wiebe. On assignment from Danzig authorities, Wiebe dredged the harbor, built windmills, drainage canals, and raised the city's walls. The artistic accomplishments of these people helped to foster a good attitude among the Danzigers toward Anabaptists. In other words, when the Anabaptists joined them in what they were doing, they were highly honored. Here's another quote from page 54. The import of raw materials as well as lace production was arranged entirely within the family, the Veer van Rooy Empire. Once again, the local lace makers voiced their ire at not getting what they thought they deserved. They ran into the council about the greed and usurped monopoly of these non-citizens, damned Anabaptists. They say Christ, but what they really mean is silk ribbons and golden tresses. But the political elite whose wives avidly desired these luxury items always decided in favor of the Mennonites, who by decree received total freedom to trade. In other words, the Mennonites were providing the things that these rich ladies wanted. And so, I guess it's once again an illustration of the neck turning the head. But what else could they do? They had to make a living somehow. Excluded from citizenship, excluded from the guilds, theirs was an uncertain existence as pioneers in foreign surroundings. Mennonites remained outsiders, without rights. They were merely tolerated. They were prevented from participating in the common pursuits of craft and industry, so they developed their own specialties. Thrown back on themselves and profiting from their iron-like communal bond, they made huge fortunes in a short time, and their frugality only compounded to the greater chagrin of the Danzig society. How in the world were these tolerated, pesky people able to advance so fast with so much capital in a short time? You can imagine they don't feel good about that. In the Netherlands, the Mennonites lost several of the strongly dogmatic faith principles they had earlier maintained. They gradually became more liberal and slowly assimilated into the surrounding society. Not so in Danzig. It was precisely the surrounding economic intolerance that brought them closer. In spite of their strongly guarded connections with the motherland, the cleft between the two groups in matters of faith grew ever wider. In other words, while Holland was drifting, Danzig at least stood firm for a while. The Danzig Old Flemish group, to which most Mennonites in Poland belonged, was keen not to lose sight of the fundamental origins of their faith. In the course of time, the Danzig Gemeinde came to be seen by the Mennonites in the Netherlands as their mother church. Okay, that probably doesn't mean so much to you. I'm reading too much here. Okay, if you want to read some more of this, you can come see me, I guess. Are we finished? Let me conclude by saying this. Our story is in the process of being written. It's not out yet. Usually it takes at least 20 years, 30 years. But sometime, people are going to be writing about us and what we did, what we failed to do. We look back and we say, we shake our heads. Do you think people look back at us and shake their heads? Just a little parting thought.